I'm Ayelet Waldman.
I'm Paul Waldman.
This is Boundary Issues.
Welcome to Boundary Issues, the podcast where two siblings solve all the world's problems while blaming each other for their own. I'm Paul.
And I'm Ayelet.
And we today are going to talk about the Supreme Court and why it is a scourge upon the land, a demon stalking our children in the night, a poison coursing through the body politic. Ayelet, do you have a question for me, or do you want me to ask you,
Yes, Paul, I have a question for you. Why did you never go to law school? Why did you get a PhD of all things?
You know, when I was in grad school,
what does that even mean?
You know, when I was in grad school getting a PhD, I actually took a class at the UPenn Law School. And then later on, I taught a class in mass media law, which was the same thing I took the class in. I never saw any reason to be a lawyer. And frankly, you know, I have a lot of friends and family who are lawyers. And every time I ask them a legal question, thinking they'll help me understand something, the answer is always, I don't know. And they never.
No, I know why you didn't go to law school. You're so full of shit. You didn't go to law school because I went to Harvard and you were afraid that you wouldn't get in. That's so simple. That's
for the record,
why you didn't go to law school.
It took less than 60 seconds for her to get that out that she went to Harvard Law. But yeah. But here's the thing. You know, I here's one thing that a story that I like to tell. So I have a friend, my friend Todd, shout out to Todd, who's a lawyer. And he once told me this thing about law school that I think I always thought applies really well to Washington, D.C., where I live. That he said in law school, you will encounter a lot of really wonderful people, smart, committed people, interesting people who want to make the world a better place and are going to do wonderful things in the world. And you will also encounter the biggest assholes you will ever meet in your life. And that's kind of like Washington, D.C. There's a lot of great people here and also the worst people.
Yeah, I would say that's pretty accurate. I would say that's pretty accurate because like I took classes with Derek Bell, who I was very close to, who was this amazing human. And I took a class with Alan Dershowitz. So, you know, there you go. Do you have a question for me, little brother?
I do. So you, I don't know if listeners remember this from earlier in the show, but you went to Harvard Law School.
I did, with Barack Obama, no less. Same class.
I was just telling somebody about the time that the Daily Caller had this scoop that you had a relationship
It was Breitbart.
And they were going to run this story.
I'm going to tell you the story. And then we really have more important things to talk about because they have an amazing guest. But I will tell you the story very briefly. So I had this boyfriend in law school named Barry. And he was African-American. And he had presidential ambitions. So the whole time we were seeing each other in our third year of law school, he was like, we can't tell anyone because if I have a white girlfriend or wife, then I won't be able to get elected president. So I kept it all a big secret, which, by the way, Derek Bell was like, don't you have any fucking self-respect? I don't think he said fucking. He didn't swear. So I go away. We break up. I go away after law school to Guatemala to learn Spanish. And he reaches out to me and he said, when I get back, he calls me. He's like, oh, my God. Clarence Thomas just got appointed to the Supreme Court. So it's totally fine for me to have a white wife. So let's get back together. And I was just like,
he made it okay for everyone.
But then fast forward for Obama's first term and I get a call from a Breitbart reporter and they say, we know that you had a secret relationship with Barack Obama. We are going to run a piece about it and we want a quote. And I'm like, you don't know, you're full of shit, but you know, do a little research and you'll figure out that you're wrong. And they immediately called people at the White House. And I was like, what do you guys want to do about this? And this is what I told them. And they're like, we'll talk to you in a second. And I wait. And about 20 minutes later, I get a call saying, if you never want to talk to them, that's totally fine by us. We don't care. So I was like, okay, message received. And I did not reply anymore. And they actually didn't run the story, which is so crazy because they did something ethical at Breitbart. Makes no sense. But okay, we're done.
Okay, I do want to say one thing about that story. I guess the idea was that it was going to be like, you know, Barack Obama dated controversial provocateur Ayelet Waldman.
Yeah, Ayelet Waldman, horrible white person.
Clearly did not understand is if you had dated Barack Obama in law school, you would have let everybody know. There is no way that would have been a secret.
That is so true. That is so true. But not if he had dated me while he was dating Michelle, because I would have kept that secret because I was a very loyal Obama acolyte. But he would never have done anything like that. Okay, you guys.
Okay, so No.
Are you not going to let me introduce the guest? Will you shut up?
I didn't ask you your question, which is why
you asked me a good enough question. I've talked about this too much. It's time to introduce Sarah. All shush. Right, fine. Sarah Lipton Lubet is the executive director of Take Back the Court, which is an organization that advocates reform and expansion of the Supreme Court. I am on the advisory board, and for the last 20 years, Sarah's been an advocate for, I mean, you name it, reproductive freedom, gender equity, progressive change. She worked at the National Partnership on Women and Families, the ACLU, the Center for Reproductive Rights, and the NRDC. But today, Sarah, welcome to the podcast to talk about, as Paul said, the deeply fucked up Supreme Court of the United States.
Thanks so much for having me.
So my first question to you is, how screwed are we post-Dobbs?
Oh, how long do you have? So two things immediately come to mind when you ask that question. One is things are going to get a lot worse until we fix them. And the other is people, I think, are more motivated than they have been in my career to stand up for abortion rights and do something about this. That's the big picture.
Do you think that makes any difference, given that all we need is one Supreme Court case that establishes a fetal personhood right, and then there's no abortion ever in America, even to save the life of the mother, because you have two competing interests? If there are two people, how do you choose which one to save? Do you think that's a likelihood, an inevitability?
So number one, I think we need to expand the Supreme Court so that never happens. Right. But we'll, I'm sure we'll get to that later. I lie awake at night worried about fetal personhood.
I mean, we should probably say what that means for people who don't know.
Sure. So this is a long-standing right-wing position, which is from the moment of conception, which usually they mean sperm meets egg. Egg meets sperm, you know, however it goes. From the moment of conception, a blastocyst has 14th Amendment rights and should be treated legally the same as actual children.
So, for example, if you have 10 blastocytes that you are planning to implant and you'll choose one, that would be akin to having 10 children and getting an AR-15 and shooting 9 in the head in terms of consequences for you for only implanting one and perhaps doing away with the others, destroying the others.
Taking it to the extreme. Yes. Yes. That's what they are saying. They are saying that these few cells frozen in a nitrogen tank are the same as your 12-year-old.
And we just heard that. We just had that ruling in Alabama. And you wrote a great piece about that. Do you want to talk a little bit about your amazing essay?
Sure. Thank you. I know this as a professional, and I know this as a person, someone who used IVF to build my own family, like so many other millions of people. So, you know, your listeners may be aware that Alabama Supreme Court recently held that frozen embryos have the same legal rights, again, as I keep trying to say like real children, born children, actual children. I don't even know.
No, you can say children. So, I feel so like insane. You can just say children.
All right, I'm
a blastocyte, a zygote, even a fetus is not a child.
So this ruling, and immediately several IVF clinics in Alabama shut down their services because they were rightfully very concerned about what this would mean legally for them. I talked to a woman in Alabama who was mid-cycle. And for those of you not incredibly familiar with IVF, you have to take a lot of shots over a long period of time to get everything just right. I mean, it's a very precise and intense set of procedures where the timing is very, very important. So she's mid-cycle getting ready for her embryo transfer. And the clinic called her the day before and said, it's off.
Jesus Christ.
It is fucking devastating.
Did you ask her who she voted for?
I didn't. I have a feeling, though. I have a feeling that you would approve. So this, you know, took me back a couple years ago to when the Dobbs decision came out, or really when it was leaked. And I was living in Arizona at the time, and Arizona has a personhood law on the books. I think at the moment it may be enjoined in litigation. I don't know, but it's there. That was terrifying. That was absolutely terrifying. I was really worried that I would lose control over what was going to happen with my embryos.
So what did you do?
I didn't have a kid yet. I mean, this was like everything. And I got them the hell out of Arizona.
You went to the clinic and you said, give me my embryos. I'm out.
Pretty much.
Wow. But my understanding is that women who have tried to do that in Alabama are not able to do those transfers because even the companies that are taking embryos and shipping them are no longer agreeing to do that from Alabama. Is that correct?
Yeah. The biggest embryo shipping company also right after that Alabama Supreme Court decision, you know, said they're not going to send embryos to Alabama and they're not going to take them from Alabama. And it's not, you can't just really like show up with your cooler. This is a very,
right. It has to be shipped in a certain
serious, really careful, really sensitive process.
That's just, it's remarkable. So the way I want to talk about this, we're going to talk about the solution, but we're going to talk a little bit more about the horrors of the Supreme Court. Cause there are things that are, everyone knows about Dobbs, but there are other things that are more subtle. So I want to talk about a case that is very close to my brother's heart, Bruin. So do you want to tell us about what Bruin held and what the ramifications of Bruin have been?
You asking me? Yes. I would love to.
No, I don't want you to do it. I want the guests to do it.
Okay.
I thought you meant Paul. I want Paul to do it.
No, I want Sarah. You can ask her the next question about Bruin, but let her give the introduction. Okay. The expert.
Bruin, same week, I think, even as Dobbs, but someone checked me on that. The Supreme Court upended a 100-plus-year-old gun safety regulation in New York, basically on the theory that if there's not a specific exact analog from the 1700s of your gun regulation, it is unconstitutional under the Second Amendment.
So for example, since machine guns didn't exist, do you think that since there's no machine gun limitation, assault weapon limitation in the United States Constitution, then you can have as many assault weapons as you want?
And the thing that I find so kind of enraging about this, I mean, I understand that the Supreme Court kind of makes up tests and standards relatively frequently for how laws and constitutional provisions are going to be applied. But I think this is the first time they've ever done this thing. And it's kind of like the natural kind of farcical endpoint of originalism. Frankly, I think we should do a whole episode on originalism.
Oh, because yeah, it is totally
bullshit top to bottom. But the idea is that, well, you know, we only care about what the founders really thought. And if you could find a single case where, say, Sam Alito ruled in a way that would not achieve the policy goal that he wanted because he was being true to the intent of the founders, I'll eat my hat. It never happens. But so what Clarence Thomas, who writes this decision, says is that you have to have a direct historical analog to any regulation on guns. We don't treat any other constitutional right that way. But in, for instance, the Rahimi case, which has not, the ruling has not yet come down, but the...
Listen to him, Sarah. He's being all law-like.
Yeah, I am. I know what I'm doing. So that was a case where you had this guy who was constantly sort of like shooting people in parking lots, and he had a restraining order against him because of a domestic violence restraining order, and he challenged it. And the question is, since there were no domestic violence restraining orders in 18th century colonial America.
And in fact, you were permitted to beat your wife under common law.
Does that mean that under Clarence Thomas's test that there's no direct historical analog, that you cannot keep guns temporarily away from people under domestic violence restraining orders? And I think it was clear in that case that if you listen to the oral arguments, although the judgment has not come down yet, that the justices, they didn't like this, you know, and they're much more political than people, I think, a lot of times would like to admit. And this is a case where they were concerned with the outcome. They weren't going to apply Clarence Thomas's new test in any kind of consistent way, because that might reach an outcome that they're not quite too comfortable with.
What do you think of this, Sarah? The idea that we now have a Supreme Court that claims to have to be following some kind of originalism doctrine, but is actually completely outcome focused. Do you think that's an accurate description of them, of what's going on inside those walls?
The Supreme Court majority basically acts as the legal arm of the Republican National Committee. I mean, that is what we have. And they are so results oriented. And the example, Paul, that you gave gives lie to the idea that they're doing anything that resembles, quote, law, right? You know, they put this history and tradition test out in the Bruin case, but it gave some of the justices like the ooks in Rahimi. And so they're just going to do something else, probably. We don't know. Always leave open the possibility that they will do something more horrific than one expects, because that often happens. But it is pretty much politics all the way down. There are folks who will say, probably myself included, that it has always been that way to some extent, but it is that way now on what's worse than steroids. I mean, it's bad.
Well, you know, I have another question about that.
Well, I'll let Paul ask a question. I'll let him ask one more.
I have another question about that as to whether or not there has been a change. And the case that really sent me batty on this was when they were hearing a challenge to President Biden's forgiveness of a bunch of student loans. And they got into this long discourse in the oral arguments about whether it was really fair. Like, if somebody who had a student loan got their loan forgiven, but yet there was somebody who didn't go to college and they got a commercial loan to build their business, would it be really fair to give the student loan borrower forgiveness? Forget about the fact that in logical terms, that's ridiculous. The government does things all the time that benefit one group and not another group. But I was watching that thinking, that's not your frigging job. There's no constitutional question at play here. There wasn't even a statutory question. They're just trying to decide if they like this policy. And I feel like I hear that all the time in oral arguments, them having these debates about, like, is this policy good? Do we like it? And I thought that wasn't supposed to be the Supreme Court's job. They're supposed to interpret statutes and interpret the Constitution. And whether or not they think a policy is good for America is not the thing that they're supposed to decide. So are they doing that more now than they used to? Or is it just that they always did that and I wasn't aware of it?
You know, I think it's a tough question. Because so many of us, and I won't include you in this, but so many of us lawyers can fall prey to elite legal brain, right? Where we get trained in this way to look up to the court and to revere them and to be proud of being in a profession where there's something called law and it's different than politics. And there's a set of constraints and it's so noble. And I used to feel that way. I think it was probably always bullshit. And also, they do, by all appearances, seem so much less constrained than ever before. They feel accountable to no one. There's nothing holding them back.
You know, I used to teach constitutional criminal procedure. I taught law after I left the public defender's office, the federal defender in LA. I taught law at Loyola Law School for a couple of semesters, and then I taught a seminar up here at Cal, which is UC Berkeley for people who don't live in California. But when I was teaching constitutional criminal procedure, it's all case law. And even when I was teaching cases with which I didn't agree, the way that you teach a law class is you're looking for the underlying principle. You teach you have a student stand up, and I taught a very Socratic class, and they discuss the facts of the case and the scenario, but really what you're looking at is what is the constitutional principle. And it was very important to me to teach students constitutional principle. How the fuck does anybody teach constitutional law now? I mean, it's
don't look at me. I don't know.
It seems so crazy to me. Before we switch gears and we talk about what Take Back the Court's solutions and advocacy is about, I just want to talk about the sort of ethical crisis that Clarence Thomas has tumbled the court into, which I don't want to get into both sides-ism. I don't want to talk about like Sotomayor taking a speech. I really want to talk about what strikes me, and I would love to know if it strikes you both, as this utter lack of ethics. Clarence Thomas is taking bribes. He's taking private, plane rides. He's taking yacht trips. he is taking bribes from a cabal of conservative money grubbers. Now, are you surprised by this, Sarah? Does this seem unusual, unprecedented, that kind of, I mean, what do you think?
It's gross. It's absolutely gross. And every other judge in the country, every other federal judge who is not on the U.S. Supreme Court has actual ethics rules that they have to follow. And, you know, you can be sanctioned if you don't follow them. There are statutory requirements and penalties, as it should be, right? Every executive branch official and employee has ethics guidelines that they need to follow. People who work in Congress have ethics guidelines they need to follow. But somehow, Clarence Thomas and his eight friends are immune to any such requirement. And I think what is so, I can't even think of the right word, I want what gets me about the way that Thomas acts in this regard is just the seething contempt for the idea that his role should be one, a justice's role should be one of a public servant. Mm. Right? That is not the way, clearly, that he thinks about his role in the court, in our democracy, and that is offensive, I think.
Do you want to know my theory on this?
I think it all
goes back to Florida 2000, which I think is kind of the genesis of so many of the horrible things in our politics, especially the Republican Party. After that whole thing, which we don't have to get into any detail, the message that the Republican Party in particular took out of that whole thing was that the only thing that matters is power, and shamelessness is a kind of superpower. You can just, you know, up to and including having the Supreme Court say, we want George Bush to be president. And so that's how we're going to make it. And guess what? He was. They won. There's like a dozen different times during that whole episode where they did something. I think the Brooks Brothers riot is really the seminal moment when they, you know, a bunch of like congressional staffers pounded on the doors and shut down the recount of the vote in Palm Beach County. And they didn't recount the votes. And they were like, oh, well, look, we did it. We like banged on the doors, like literally a violent mob. And it worked. And we didn't pay any consequence for it. And George Bush got to be president at the end of it. And so I think that was the real lesson was that if you just don't have any shame, you can win. And each one of these cases where, you know, Clarence Thomas like is taking luxury vacations and a loan for a big RV and stuff, and they circle the wagons. And then in the end, what happens? Well, nothing happens. He's still on the Supreme Court. And, you know, Donald Trump is on tape bragging about his ability to sexually assault women with impunity, and they circle the wagons around him. And what happens? He wins. And each one of these episodes just reinforces the idea that shame is for suckers. And if you just hold out and everybody on your side gets behind you, you can do whatever you want, and you'll still have the power to outlaw abortion and to make it so you can't regulate guns and to utterly dismantle the administrative state. Power is what matters, and shame is an impediment to power. That's my theory of the whole case. It all goes back to Florida 2000.
That's a great theory. So what are we going to do about the court, Sarah? What are we going to do about the court?
So that's what makes the approach that, you know, to date, so many kind of conventional wisdom folks have taken to the court just mind exploding, right? Because they sit back and say, well, you know, if we adhere to our decorum and if we make a very serious face, then eventually, you know, the court will come back into compliance with general norms, and there's an ebb and flow, and you just kind of have to wait this thing out because anything else would be unseemly. There is no ebb and flow. Republicans have appointed the majority of justices on the Supreme Court for more than 50 years. Studies show that try to map it out, right? That's going to be the same for the next 50 years. It's 100 years of single party rule, minority party rule of the Supreme Court. And it's not going to change itself. That's the first thing that I really want people to understand. It's not going to fix itself.
So what do we do?
We got to expand it. We have to expand and rebalance the court. Now, there are a lot of reforms that we badly need. It is a deeply broken, rotten institution. We've talked about so many of the ways in just the last, 10 minutes. It's rotten from the center out. And there is no way with this current set of justices that things will get better. They won't even stay the same. It's going to continue. I mean, just think about in the last 2 years, the monumental changes that they've made. So we need to rebalance the Supreme Court so that it has a majority of justices that care about the Constitution, that care about law, that care about the court's role in a democracy, don't want to be a super legislature, you know, having the final word on all policy decisions.
What would be the size of the Supreme Court that you think makes sense?
So there are a few different ideas out there about size. We support a bill called the Judiciary Act, which would increase the size from 9 to 13. I will admit, I did not know this before starting to work in this area, that there's nothing special about the number 9. The Constitution doesn't say how many justices should be on the Supreme Court. That is left to Congress to decide. Congress has set the number, changed the number a number of times in the past, and it is completely within their authority to do it if they have the courage and the will.
So why don't they have the courage and the will? Why doesn't the Democratic Party, when we had, for example, the House, the Senate, and the presidency, why is the Democratic Party so weak-willed, stupid, pathetic, and useless that they, and full of shame, maybe if you think about Paul's theory, that they will not to date consider it? Because people like Biden have been absolute impediments to these bills going forward, right?
So there are some folks who are really out leading on the vanguard on this issue. Senator Warren, Senator Tina Smith, Ed Markey, a lot of great folks in the House. And if you'd asked me this question 2 years ago when we were waiting for the Dobbs opinion, I would have said, I think they just don't believe how bad things will get, mm-hmm. right? It's denial. You know, I spend a lot of time talking to a lot of people about Supreme Court reform, and what I hear from a lot of folks is, well, you know, maybe when it's really bad enough, that'll be the time to act. If that's not now, I don't know what that is. Dobbs, Bruin, the justices just basically tried to put their thumb on the scale for Trump in the 2024 election. In multiple ways. I mean, we are going to lose the possibility of making changes to protect our democracy if we don't do it soon.
Do you think that there are a lot of Democrats who feel like there's something kind of unseemly about playing that kind of hardball, that, you know, they're the institutionalists, they're the responsible ones, and they don't want to get down into this kind of grubby playing with the rules in a way that might advantage their party, because that's the kind of thing that other side does. And we who are so noble and committed to these institutions, that would be beneath us to do that kind of thing. Is that a response that you think is there, whether implicitly or explicitly?
There's 100%. I think what many of them are thinking, as the Republicans burn our institutions to the ground, I don't know, take a shovel, make a hole for the ash. I can't even, there's not enough, metaphors to really grapple with direness of the situation that we're in. And look, sometimes I like a little denialism too, right? It feels shitty to look the crisis in the eye all the time.
And it's literally your job if you're a legislator, though, isn't it?
One would hope. And the thing about that discomfort, right, the discomfort with the getting your hands dirty style of politics, is all we're asking them to do is to take the problem seriously and advance a legislative solution for it, right? There's nothing dirty or underhanded happening. They're not trying to, you know, prevent Merrick Garland from having a hearing. They're not, you know, rushing through Amy Coney Barrett after people have already started to vote in the 2020 election. It's about passing a piece of legislation. That's what Congress is supposed to do. So the distaste component is really overstated.
You know, I listen to the language from the Democratic Party and I hear them say over and over again, pack the court, pack the court. We're not going to pack the court. We don't want to pack the court. I find that so enraging. This idea that that expresses this kind of, oh, there's something wrong. You know, what happens when you go in to lobby them and you say, we're talking about expanding the court pursuant to a statute that is completely illegitimate and has precedent in the history of the United States? First of all, who are the biggest fucking morons who stand in the way? Democratic pieces of shit who stand in the way. Please name them. Do you not want to? She doesn't want to.
It's impolitic.
All right. Okay, it's impolitic. Yeah, you have to get your job done. So if you go on a podcast and you say that person, I'm pretty sure we can Google this, Paul, right? And only put it in if it's right. But like, doesn't Chuck Schumer kind of stand in our way? Sarah's just never going to answer that question. Maybe when you're not on the show, we will give a list of pieces of shit that are standing in the way. But when you go in and you say to them, you talk to them in this very reasonable, rational way that presents all this evidence, historical, legal, constitutional, what is the response?
It's a lot of nodding. I think the question we get all the time, including from well-meaning people, is, well, if we do this, what will keep the Republicans from making the court even bigger the next time they're in control? They already took control. They've been in control forever, right? Not doing something in the face of that, it's just surrender in a way that, you know, I think is not unfamiliar to a lot of people on issues with some politicians. But a world in which we expand the court, rebalance it for some period of time, and then they hijack it again, that's better than a world in which Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito just continue to do whatever they want nonstop with no break.
And make it permanently impossible for us to do any changing, because what part of their project is to destroy democracy in America. And do you think I'm overstating that? I'm not overstating that. Can you describe some of the things that they are doing to make the democratic experiment of the United States officially over?
I really don't think you're exaggerating at all. And this is part of my hobby horse, right? Beating the drum, whatever it is that I can't stop doing, which is we have to look the crisis in its face. And we can't just kind of turn away because it's too upsetting otherwise. This is a court that in case after case has stacked the deck for Republicans. And I mean that both in the partisan sense with the court's voting rights jurisprudence and in the policy sense, all sorts of things, real unpopular, that Republicans would not be able to do, haven't been able to do via legislation that the Supreme Court just comes in and does by judicial fiat. So in both of those ways, the court is dramatically undermining our democracy in a way that I think you may have just said, or maybe Paul said, I don't remember, that we may not be able to come back from.
Why is there no sense of urgency or insufficient sense of urgency? I mean, I look at the Democratic Party, and this is my hobby horse. The stuff we are worried about, particularly the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, where I reside or thought I resided, is so relatively inane on a political level. I mean, it's really important on a personal level. It's really important to human beings. But right now, none of that is going to mean anything if you don't focus on the end of democracy. So I do believe that at least some legislators understand that. So why aren't we seeing any of the sense of urgency around the Supreme Court and around the demise of democracy that we should be seeing?
I think if I could, put in
my two cents. Yeah, Paul, you might have a thought about this.
I think it's a few different things. First of all, the discussion that they see about Supreme Court cases tends to be kind of arcane and difficult for like regular people to understand and connect to their lives. And a lot of what the Supreme Court does to undermine democracy is not like one big case when they say like, you know, black people can't vote anymore. It's sort of a death by a thousand cuts. They're going to undermine labor unions and they're going to change this rule and that rule, you know, and if you try to tell people about, if you had 20 minutes to explain to somebody why Shelby County was an abomination, then you could do it. But if
tell,
they just
tell our audience what Shelby is.
Shelby County was when John Roberts, who, by the way, people think of him as the moderate in some ways, maybe he is, but the sole animating goal of his life is to undermine voting rights. And that was the case where he basically said that since racism is over, even though Congress had multiple times reauthorized the Civil Rights Act, he was going to eviscerate it, he and the rest of the majority in the Supreme Court, and among other things, the Voting Rights Act, that he was going to remove the requirement for places where there had been lots and lots of invidious discriminatory voting laws, that he was going to remove the requirement for preclearance, which means that they have to get permission from the Justice Department before they can change their voting laws. And literally within hours of that decision coming down, Southern states started to move to have different kinds of voter suppression laws, and then in some ways have been very effective. But
and very specifically targeted at black voters.
Oh, yeah.
Very specifically targeted at the very voters the Voting Rights Act was supposed to protect. And so giving lie within 25 minutes to Roberts' claim that, oh, nobody is going to suppress the votes of black people, no more.
But then once what you get then is years of cases about pretty specific things, laws that have to do with the way district lines are drawn or the rules around polling places. And each one of those is another little bite at voting rights. And it's not like Dobbs, where all of a sudden they come down with a decision and now it is illegal in the state of Texas or wherever you live to get an abortion. And that's something big and direct and immediate that people can see. And a lot of the voting rights stuff has been like a little bit here, a little bit there, all moving in the same direction, but not that kind of one big case that makes everybody understand what they're losing.
That was the story of abortion rights, of reproductive rights, up until Dobbs, right? Up until that moment, it had been decades of chipping away, constraining, upholding all these ridiculous pieces of legislation that were just designed to make abortion functionally inaccessible for people depending on what state they lived in, how much money they made. And that whole time, there were a lot of us saying, this is going in a very bad direction and we need to fix it. Then Dobbs came, and to people who were paying less attention to it, right? Or who didn't have as much reason to be aware, it felt like this seismic shift, which isn't to say that I think you're wrong about the way that the voting rights cases have been working and people's awareness of them. I think you're right. And I think we need to figure out how to be more clear about what's going on in a way that people can understand before there's a Dobbs-like decision, if Shelby wasn't already that.
So, Sarah, I have a question for you. Has there been polling on issues of reforming the court? And if so, what has it said?
You know, there's been polling on a bunch of different issues around the Supreme Court. I think that one of the ones that stands out to me the most is the way in which the court's reputation has plummeted since Dobbs. It used to be fairly high, even though, you know, the court has done many terrible things before Dobbs. But since then, you know, I don't know remember the numbers off the top of my head, it's dropped something like 20 points, and it's stayed down. And I think that's attributable to a few things. One is the outcome of the decision in Dobbs. People want abortion rights. It's hugely popular. We kind of like our fundamental right to bodily autonomy. And also that decision and others really exposed the way in which the court is just doing politics and wearing robes while doing it. So that really kind of sets the foundation for the work to come on court reform. Court expansion, it's not something a lot of people have heard about, but even expansion, I mean, despite my best efforts, even expansion, Marquette, which is like the holy grail of Supreme Court polling has it at majority support.
What about term limits? Have they polled on term limits?
So term limits are more popular.
I mean, there is no reason that an ancient, demented narcissist like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and yes, I said it, should have been serving on the Supreme Court so long that she was able to destroy anything resembling a legacy that she had had. The idea that we sit frantically hoping that elderly people don't die and thus democracy can cling to a last shred. Is there anywhere else in the world that they do this? That 95-year-olds blithering, you know, I mean, God, like I'm going to be 95 and I'm already a blithering idiot. But like, is there anywhere, shut up. Is there anywhere else in the world where people who have, you know, who are so old can cling to power in this way that is so destructive and dangerous?
Yeah, I don't think there's any place else that has lifetime appointments for judges. And the term limit proposal that I've seen that seems to make the most sense is that every justice gets an 18-year term, and every presidential term they get two more appointments, and two judges would be moved off into some kind of senior status where they couldn't do any more harm. And that seems like a perfectly logical thing. We kind of remove all of these games about who's going to get more. It's still remarkable that in 8 years, Barack Obama got two appointments and Donald Trump got three in 4 years. And it's remarkable.
Well, because Obama didn't have a Senate.
Yes.
Just like, you know, actively just trying to force, I mean, doing the most incredible machinations and dishonest, like, oh no, it's too close to the election. Oh my God, let's get it through before the election. You know,
And it's incredible that the party that has won the popular vote in 7 of the last 8 presidential elections has 3 justices, and the party that has lost the popular vote in 7 of the last 8 elections has 6 justices. And I think there's also a misconception that a lot of people have that's sort of built out of that kind of brief period between, like, let's say Brown v. Board of Education and Roe v. Wade. Brown v. Wade was what, 54, 55? And 1973 with Roe v. Wade, that the Supreme Court is kind of inherently liberal. When in fact, like, just if you just take that out, the entire history of the Supreme Court is that it is a deeply conservative institution that is always trying to resist social change and turn it backwards. And, you know, I think that liberals don't really understand that the court kind of has always been their enemy, except for that brief period. It's not just this court. And they have to, you know, make some effort to start to kind of seize control of it, or it's going to continue to be that way and get even worse.
Sarah, tell us a little bit, since we've been plowing over you, because we both feel a little strongly about this.
I love it.
Tell us who's on the advisory board, because there's some really important legal scholars on the advisor and also political figures on the advisory board of Take Back the Court. I mean, first of all, Ayelet Waldman, clearly
that's
fountain
where you were going.
Of legal knowledge.
I heard she went to Harvard.
I understand that's the case.
you know, we are so, so lucky to have incredible scholars and thinkers as part of our advisory board. I'm going to name them. And then I want to go back and say something about term limits that I have to get off my chest before we're done. You know, folks like Harvard law professor Larry Tribe, former federal judge Nancy Gertner, Professor Michael Klarman. This is like thanking people at my wedding, and I feel like I'm like forgetting who to say.
With the Oscars.
Professor Carol Anderson. It's really, if I do say so myself, kind of a who's who of forward-looking liberal thinkers and constitutional scholars.
So tell us, what is the thing you want to talk about with term limits?
So here's the thing about term limits. No 9 people should have this much power. And no 9 people should have this much power for their entire lifetimes. We need term limit reforms. That's clear. We need court expansion first. Because anything we try to do to bring some balance and sanity and integrity back to the Supreme Court is going to get shut down by them until and unless we've rebalanced it.
because they will be the arbiters of any attempt we make, right?
That's
the
genius.
They have arrogated to themselves all power.
That's the genius of like Leonard Leo in this whole like multi-decade long effort by the Federal Society. They just realized like, oh, if we can capture the courts, then like that's the whole game. We own the refs.
The Judicial Conference, which is a body that sets kind of rules and policies and procedures for federal courts, came out with a suggestion, a proposed policy that tries to tamp down on judge shopping, where any kind of radical reactionary anybody can create a new organization in Amarillo, Texas, and get their case heard by Judge Kaczmarek.
So we should say that there are rules about where your case will be heard. You can't just say, oh, I'm going to have a case heard in, you actually have to have like an office. You have to be doing business in the state. But you can open an office, you know, with a P.O. box, right?
Apparently. This is kind of the definition of a minor, at the margins, good government kind of rule. People shouldn't be able to game the system to go to one particular judge who then issues a nationwide injunction that halts our immigration policy or makes medication abortion illegal. It is the farthest from radical, I think, that you could get. And yet, today, Mitch McConnell is sending letters to chief judges in districts around the country saying, you don't have to abide by this. It's partisan and Democrats are terrible and keep doing what you're doing, district court judges. We don't think it's important to have rules that are fair. I mean, it's like the most anodyne thing that a body could do about court reform. And still, you know, McConnell is out there calling it an attack on America and American justice, basically, which leads me to this very long-winded point of saying, we shouldn't be afraid to do things that actually fix problems because Republicans might call it partisan or radical.
And I think that's so true. And I also think we need to have an imagination that will allow us. Like the thing that made me the most angry about Dobbs is that we had the opinion and we did nothing. The organizations, so few of them were working hard, knowing the opinion between the time the draft opinion was leaked until the opinion became law. I don't know what, for example, Planned Parenthood was doing, but they weren't working on this. So I really feel like we were saying for so long, the Supreme Court, the second they can, they will ban abortion. And now I feel like we're screaming into the wind, there will be no IVF. There will be prosecutions, including punishments with the death penalty of women who have abortions. And I'm not talking about in week 29. I'm talking about women who have an abortion before there's a heartbeat. They are going to prosecute them and they are going to put them to death. And you know, you sound like people look at you like you're crazy when you say things, but they also would have looked at you like you were crazy when you said that some justice in Alabama was going to end up banning IVF. So I think it's so important. We are going to have a fetal personhood constitutional ruling 100%. That's going to mean there's no abortion anywhere in the country. We're going to have prosecutions of people who mail abortion pills. There are going to be people incarcerated all over the country and people put on death row for abortion. And until the Democratic Party is willing to accept and understand that and stop talking about nonsense, this feels like an inevitability to me. So I want to thank you for the work you do, Sarah. I want anybody who's listening to this podcast to scream the words court reform every single time that it is even remotely. Like, listen, if I can cram the words Harvard Law School into any conversation, you can cram the words court reform into any conversation. You're amazing, Sarah. Thank you for devoting your life to causes that people don't think about often enough. And thank you for being such an articulate spokesperson for something so critical.
Thank you both so much. For letting me yammer at you for so long, and for everything you do.
What do I do? Nothing. For our work. You're the one
it's
who's
true.
Doing it all.
She does nothing. All right. Thank you, Sarah. This has been a great conversation. Not particularly cheery, but the work goes on.
Boundary Issues is produced and edited by Paul Waldman. Our music is by Zeke Chabon. If you'd like to get in touch, you can email us at waldmanpodcast@gmail.com. And this is a listener-supported podcast. So if you'd like to support us, you can go to patreon.com/boundaryissues. See you next time.